Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joining you at the second segment of the program today with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. So let's get started with the market report for Thursday, January 28th, 2016. And let's go with gold right away. You know, I was hoping we could get even closer to 1150, but it went in the wrong direction today. Down 11, but I'm not worried about gold and silver at 1114.70. You have silver down 26 at 1432. Platinum was down 17 at 868. Palladium was down 8 at 494. So a little bit of pressure on the white metals today, and it surprised me a little bit because the dollar was down. The dollar was down 0.34 at 98.59. Crude oil was up 1.31 at 33.61, and of course the markets were all in green territory today with the Dow. Let's get to Come on, computer, bring up my market report. Saying it's Thursday, I'm slow. The Dow was up 124 points at 16,069, so we're back up over 16. The NASDAQ was up 38, 4506. The S&P was up 10, 1893. Interesting, the 10-year yield did drop below 2. 1.98% for the yield on the 10-year, down 0.02. The euro, 109, up 0.33, as that mirrors the opposite of the dollar. And Germany was down big overnight, almost 2.5% for Germany. Everything else was pretty much all below 1%. And I did see, I think China was down another 2%. Let me get to my other screen here. China, yes, almost 3% at 26.55. 26.55 for the Shanghai. So, and again, I said, you're going to see that number, probably around 2,000, 1,900. And it might even dip to 1,500. But that's where it really should be. And so it's just coming back to reality as what we will see in most of the world markets do. I just want to make a brief comment You know, the news media, I mean, this whole thing with Trump and Fox, and it's like, good Lord, get a grip on things. Is that the most important news out there? And I find it disgusting, maybe not so much surprising, really. I'm not surprised, but I still find it disgusting. And even on the website like Drudge Report, so little time has been given to the shooting in Oregon. Very little mention of what happened in Oregon. More airtime has been given to Trump and his little feud with Fox. And whether you agree or whether you disagree with what fueled the situation in Oregon, it shouldn't be swept under the rug. And this is exactly what is happening. Is it a coincidence that you have everything just so focused on the debate and what's going on with Donald Trump at the same time? So let's see how this gets reported on after the fiasco this evening and after Iowa, you know, the first of next week. But then again, it's not surprising, but disgusting, and how everyone can be so focused on what is going on just because Donald Trump is not showing up with his little feud. It's just a sign of the time, folks. Just a sign of the times. And, you know, with all this distraction, there's a report today on the durable goods. That's the demand for long-lasting factory goods. That declined, which is another hit to the U.S. manufacturing sector. Now, get this. New orders for durable goods, which is, you know, computers, you know, you have your big items, airliners and things like that, but also washing machines and refrigerators, household goods. That fell 5.1% in December from the prior month. This report at one time was followed very closely. I mean, the gauge of durable good orders was watched. It was like a forward-looking signal because, you know, sometimes it would take months or even years, you know, for a car, ship, or the big items to be delivered. And if consumers were ordering washing machines, they were probably going out to restaurants. If you had businesses that was investing in computers, I mean, things are good, and most likely they were hiring. So that number was watched. And it was kind of like the Baltic Dry Index. So for December, with it dropping to 5.1%, I guess that means people are not buying durable items and their restaurant habits, you know, are not as strong as what we're being told. And now for all of 2015, durable good orders fell 3.5%. And it was the first annual decline in demand for long-lasting manufactured goods since 2009. And we also have to assume that maybe these numbers are tweaked somehow, some way. Most likely they're probably a little worse. And I believe Friday they come out with the GDP number. So that should prove, which is tomorrow, which will prove to be interesting. You're going to hear that China's to blame, or maybe Brazil and maybe some other markets as their economy's slow. There'll probably be little mention, or maybe they will mention a lot that the stronger dollar, it makes our products more expensive. So who's going to buy any product that's built here in the United States? So again, they're going to continue to gut the rest of America as more jobs and people flee this. Well, people aren't fleeing this country. Well, you know, some might say they are, but I mean, workers are losing their jobs along with these jobs leaving this country. Thursday's report, this report is broken down a little bit because I don't want to talk about Donald Trump. Thursday's report showed, and I know I already did, but Thursday's report showed non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft, fell 4.3%. This was December from the prior month. Let's see what else. Orders for transportation goods fell 12.4%. This was led by a 29.4% decrease in non-defense aircraft orders. Civilian aircraft orders were down 32%. And I guess it doesn't take a lot for, you know, when you're looking at something really big to really have a huge, you know, impact percentage-wise. But they were down 32.7% from 2015. Military spending plummeted. Orders for defense capital goods decreased by 34% in December. Let's see. Even demands for cars and trucks. And hey, that's all you heard about in 2015. This was the bright spot of our economy, showing us that, hey, people are out there spending. And again, that shows that that weekend last month has weakened. Orders for motor vehicles and parts fell 0.4% in December. And I already mentioned that they'll be releasing the fourth quarterly gross domestic product on Friday. I can't imagine that's going to be a good number. So I would think that markets will be pretty volatile tomorrow. But you have to love how they spin these bad numbers. You know, the durable goods, oh, it's bad. But you know what? It's not as bad as it once was, because the durable good numbers once reflected manufacturing. So if those numbers were bad, that meant manufacturing was down. That means jobs were lost and people were laid off. But they say it's not so bad anymore because we don't have those manufacturing jobs anymore. So that's how they're spinning that, hey, it's okay. You know, it's no big deal anymore because it doesn't have that big of an impact on our economy. Manufacturing accounts for about 12% of our economic output and less than 10% of all jobs. Pretty pathetic. So they spin it. So while there's a slowdown in the sector, will drag on growth, it doesn't necessarily point to a broader economic slowdown. This is why they spin it. The economy is increasingly driven by consumer spending on services, a category that is expanding steadily. Now, would you rather have services supporting our economy or manufacturing supporting our economy? Manufacturing, where at one time people worked their whole lives. People would work for a company for 30, 40, 50 years. Their whole working career, they worked for a factory. They had good income. They had benefits. They had retirement. They had security. Or would you rather have an economy that is based on consumer spending on services? Not even products, but services. Most of these jobs are part-time, low wages, no benefits with health care. And you have health care increasing 20 to 50%. And they don't even pay that. And forget retirement. People are in trouble. They don't even have $1,000 in their checking account in case of an emergency. How does that, any of that, equal any type of security? Are you kidding me? But they're going to come out and say, hey, these numbers just don't mean as much as they once did. Our economy is still doing better. Well, let's take a look at a little bit of our back history. Manufacturing, small part of the U.S. economy, 12%. About the same size as professional and business services. In 1997, the first year for which the government had data on gross domestic product by industry, manufacturing accounted for about 16% of the economy. Businesses and services accounted for just 9.8%. Let's go back to World War II. More than a third of workers held manufacturing jobs. The share remained above 20% into the 80s. Last year, manufacturers added 30,000 jobs. That's the smallest increase of the expansion. The broader economy, you know, if you believe those numbers, which I don't. So this is how they spin the illusion. Manufacturing was the heart of this country and is barely beating anymore. And we see this in temperament. We see this in our family. We see this as people being angry, as I talked about yesterday. Manufacturing just doesn't mean that much anymore. And that's good? I don't think so. So again, this is how they'll spin it. Again, we'll see how that GDP number comes out on Friday. I just picked up a couple of reports that I saw interesting today. 20 minutes goes by so quick. British court cleared six brokers trying to fix the benchmark interest rate known as LIBOR. That's a pet peeve of mine. We have Rod West on here. He's done some, he's writing a book about the LIBOR rate scandal. Six men had been accused of helping convicted banker Tom Hayes manipulate the LIBOR rate, the key rate the banks use to borrow money from each other over 4 years. Do you really believe that seven men were able to manipulate the biggest, you know, the most used rate in the world, where it affects trillions and trillions of dollars on a daily basis, and they get off? Tom Hayes, he was accused. He was sent to jail, 14 years in prison. But the six were cleared today, and they get an applause. It's amazing. Even little Timmy Geithner, when he was in office, yeah, I knew. I knew they were fixing the LIBOR rate. The LIBOR affects trillions of dollars in contracts, mortgages, bonds. Everyone knew that it was being rigged. And what, a couple billion dollars, maybe even millions, I don't know if it was millions or billions, are paid by the central banks. You know, no guilt was admitted. You have seven guys, one goes to jail, and six of them get off, and the courtroom, everyone applauds. And it's amazing. Really, I guess I should call Thursday Amazing News Day. And these are the ones that you just kind of scratch your head. Well, since the sanctions came off of Iran, they're touring Europe. You know, they want to go back and recreate their old relationship with Europe, as they were big trading partners before all the sanctions were placed on them. They're currently in France, and France's government welcomed Iranian President Rouhani today with promises of a new beginning in an old relationship, starting with investments to boost Iran's flagging economy, crippled by decades of sanctions over its nuclear activities. He arrived in Paris on Wednesday from Italy, where billions of euros worth of trade deals were reached. About 20 agreements will be signed after a meeting. PSA Peugeot announced a joint venture with Iran Kudro to produce latest generation vehicles in Tehran by the end of 2017. Gee, I haven't heard of any business arrangements with the U.S. and Iran. They get, you know, we give them back their $1.5 billion, and now they get to rekindle their relationship with Europe. So, you know, it's just like, really? What benefit did the U.S. get? All of this bidding, all of these negotiations seems to have been done for the benefit of Europe. And maybe we are now beginning to see who really pulls the strings in Washington. It's no longer the secret. I don't think they really care anymore. Let's see what I thought was interesting about that report. They talked about the West. See if I can pull this up here. There were people who were demonstrating there. There was an open letter to Hollande condemning Iran's human rights record, with executions on the rise, and what it's called its strategy of chaos in the Middle East. You know, human rights really don't seem to be a no consequence anymore around the world. An activist hung from a fake noose off a Paris bridge next to a huge banner reading, "Welcome Rouhani, Executioner of Freedom." But he also took digs at the West regarding the migrant crisis. He says Europeans, with all their economic power and resources, we're saying 100,000 migrants have arrived to our soil. And what do we do now? 200,000 have swarmed our borders. What do we do now? Well, I think he's a little low in his count. You know, I think Germany alone was getting up to 1 million. And when you look at 100,000 and 200,000, those were the numbers that were here for the U.S. But he said Iran is hosting 3 million Afghans without complaining. Well, yeah. What he doesn't say is if anybody does complain, you get executed. So, you know, you're not going to have anybody complain in Iran. And I'm going to complain because my 20 minutes is gone, and I wanted to talk about Russia. And just briefly, I haven't heard this, but they're sending the 101st Airborne Division to Syria and Iraq. That was announced on the 25th, a couple days ago. And but another day. We'll talk about it maybe tomorrow. 1-800-375-4188. Stay tuned. And Alfred and James Corbett will be here with you in just a few short minutes.
PSA count high? Half of all men over 50 have an enlarged prostate. You can shrink your prostate without harmful drugs or risky surgery. The secret to healing the prostate is to cleanse the prostate and the liver. Call Apothecary Herbs to ask about the Prostate Kit for a comprehensive way to heal and soothe your prostate. Educate yourself on how easy it can be to disinfect, cleanse, and restore your prostate gland. Call Apothecary Herbs for the Prostate Kit and successfully reduce swelling, inflammation, dissolve stones, and cleanse the blood to obtain the results you need. Money-back guarantee with every purchase. Call the experts in organ cleansing. Call Apothecary Herbs now for the Prostate Kit and empower yourself. Toll free 866-229-3663 for international callers 704-875-8010. That's toll free 866-229-3663 or visit the web at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Apparently the music was playing when I couldn't hear it, and I was talking. I don't know if anyone heard me. They didn't hear me. James Corbett is joining us now. Hello, James. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Alfred. Thank you for having me back on, as always.
Always a pleasure to have you back on the program. How's the Corbett Report doing?
Well, I would say it's doing fairly well. And good. As a matter of fact, since you bring it up, I would like to let your audience know that we've just started a new open source investigation trying to piece together all of the information that we can find from all of the different countries of the world about moving towards a cashless society. Because I noticed earlier this week there was a story up about Norway, and the largest bank in Norway, one of the executives of that bank, gave a interview to a newspaper saying that they want to move Norway into a cashless society. And it was one of those stories that we see those types of stories come and go through the news all the time. And so I had the idea, I want to actually collect as many of those types of pieces of information as we can about all the different the countries that it's taking place in, the French restriction on cash transactions, the Spanish restriction on cash transactions, the Indian and Israeli and Canadian and Filipino and all the other governments that are moving towards eliminating cash or phasing cash out or restricting cash. So we're starting that right now, and so Corbett Report members are leaving their comments there, and I'm trying to put it into the article, and we're amassing quite a collection of these types of stories. It's quite interesting.
Well, it is interesting because it's a global phenomenon, and it seems to be just taking place, and people, it's as if you're watching a flock of birds flying overhead. So, oh, look at that, a bunch of geese are flying south or whatever. No one seems to look at this and say, wait a second, this is happening globally and it can't just be coincidental. The powers that be are mandating this, and it's only a question of time, presumably, before it happens in China and Japan and here in the United States. We aren't going to have any cash.
Well, this is the point to me of this and so many other stories, is that we always tend to just see what's happening in our local area and think of that as the sort of news. But it is happening all around the world simultaneously. And to a certain extent, with a story like this, you understand new technologies are coming online and banks are going to try to take advantage of them. But it is something that is happening all around the world at the same time. And we have to be aware we are stepping into this completely controlled, completely surveilled transaction grid that is locking into place. And when you pepper that in with stories about how these international banking agreements, like the FATCA agreement that the U.S. has tried to strong arm various countries around the world into signing so that they all give up their personal banking information over to the U.S. authorities. I mean, those types of things, when you put them together, it's a world where increasingly you're not going to be able to do, buy, sell, or transact with anyone unless it's under the eye of the watchful central bankers and their bankster cronies. So it's worrying when you put it in that perspective. But of course, we never get that perspective from any one of these news stories.
I know, it's just taken for granted. Oh, isn't that that's kind of interesting, a little bit odd, but nobody's paying any attention to it. And it signals we're looking at some sort of an economic revolution, a political revolution that's taking place on a global basis right now, and nobody seems to mind. Nobody objects. Nobody speaks up, at least, you know, not significantly.
And so, I think it also further speaks to the fact that the political revolution you're talking about is fundamentally undergirded by a financial transactional infrastructure that is being carefully put into place by all these groups that are working in coordinated agenda. And again, unless you understand that part, you can fall into this political, oh, you know, let's vote for team A or team B, and as if it will make a fundamental difference to the control mm-hmm. grid that is going in right now.
I have suspected for years that the essence of the New World Order is fiat currency. If they don't have fiat currency, they're not going to run the world. With fiat currency, they can. Without fiat currency, they can't. If they can't spin currency out of thin air, well, to me, this is evidence. When they go ahead and they say there's not going to be any more cash, we're just going to do it. We'll have digital currency. Everyone's going to have a little plastic card. For me, this is New World Order. This is evidence they are getting close to trying to impose something. How long do you suppose it's going to be before the world either wakes up and starts to put the brakes on this, resist this, or this becomes a fait accompli and they're going to just, everybody's going to have little plastic cards?
Well, I don't think we'll have to wait very long for the answer to that. Danish government has set the deadline of 2030 for eliminating cash from Denmark. And Australia, a new survey that's come out from a banking group with online banking services. So, you know, take this report for what it's worth. But at any rate, they say that they're predicting Australia to be cash-free by 2022. And we have similar pronouncements coming out around the world, with actually some countries really moving quite close to that precipice already. I think Canada's down to something like the 8% mark in terms of overall transactions. How many are actually cash-based at this point? Something down around 8%. I mean, it's not inconceivable that they'll be able to squelch that down below 1% in the near future. So, especially because the Canadian
government... Same thing in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding, and I may be mistaken about this, but it's my understanding that about 95% of our transactions right now are achieved with plastic, or at least with checks, but not with paper dollars. Only represents about 5% of the transactions, which means we're almost cash-free already.
I would have to check those numbers. I know that the actual money supply itself is something like 5% or even less actual cash.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the transaction percentage.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't even know if you can get accurate. You can get numbers that you can rely on. Mm-hmm. You hopefully you rely on. It's part of the problem.
Well, that is part of the problem from the banker's perspective, because they don't know how many dollar bills people have stuffed under their mattresses or buried in the backyard. So, you know, until they get that complete control over the financial system that comes with that cashless society, they will never be able to fully know exactly how much money is in circulation.
I saw one report where they guesstimated that 75% of all of the paper dollars in the world, not digital, paper, but 75% are overseas. They're in foreign hands, and they hold them as world reserve currency and banks. They hold them in their mattresses, whatever, and that only 25% of the total currency that's printed right now, physical currency, only about 25% is actually in circulation in the United States. So I don't know. The whole thing is strange, and we are living, you know, in interesting times. Ancient, Chinese or Japanese curse?
But unfortunately, that is not surprising to people in, say, Brazil right now, or Argentina or Venezuela, where they're having incredible turmoil in their own markets right now. So holding dollars, if people had been holding their savings in dollars, U.S. dollars, it would have been beneficial to them at this point, as their currencies are now collapsing, which is why I think you see that hoarding of physical dollars in a lot of places around the world.
I saw an article just recently, and I know that I have it here close at hand. Now, here it is. Not even the darkest minds imagined it would be this bad for China. That's the headline. This is from Business Insider. There are other things to talk about in this article, but one of the things they talked about is that you can blame a good portion of the chaos, the problems in China, on the depreciating value of the yuan, which has spurred holders of the currency to ditch it for something more stable. Now, that's an interesting statement to me, because they didn't say they're going to ditch it for something more valuable. They said they're going to ditch it for another fiat currency, and they're all technically worthless, but they're looking for a fiat currency that's more stable. It doesn't have to be precisely stable, but it doesn't change as rapidly, and so they are pulling their wealth out of China and moving it, looking for a more stable, worthless currency. And that strikes me as interesting. Not more valuable, more stable. Does that inspire any comment out of you?
I see the distinction. Having said that, as I say, for people who are living through currency devaluation, I don't think whether or not something has a commodity backing it up is of primary importance. Again, if you're in Brazil and you're suddenly seeing your life savings being flushed down the toilet because of currency depreciation, you don't care if the dollar fundamentally doesn't have gold backing it up. You just want
to
buy your bread.
That's
so,
right.
I mean, value is what people make of it to that extent. But I think I understand the point that you're making, that ultimately what we are in is the system where all of these various central banks have these competing fiat currencies, and it's a question of, you know, which one will be the better investment for now, or what will be more stable, or what can you hang on to the value that you have with. And it becomes that type of calculation. So you understand why the Chinese nouveau riche would be trying to secure some of their earnings in something that's more, quote unquote, stable. But yeah, I see the point that you're making, that at the end of the day, I mean, there's nothing to prevent the U.S. dollar from becoming unstable. In fact, that's exactly where it's heading in the long term.
Well, again, here's the headline. Not even the darkest minds imagined it would be this bad for China. And what they're saying is that $1 trillion in capital fled from China in 2015. Previous years, they only lost about $130 billion per year. Now, all of a sudden, they're losing $1 trillion per year. The government predicted they'd lose about $455 billion. They've actually lost about $1 trillion. This situation has deteriorated rather very rapidly. Is this article the idea that things are dark for China? Is this hyperbolic, or is this an accurate assessment of what's happening in China right now?
I think it is not far off the mark. I don't know how far or close it may be, but it isn't so far off the mark, just based on the actions of the People's Bank of China right now, which is furiously injecting liquidity into the markets. And I don't have the tally of exactly how much has been injected so far this year. But I note, one of the headlines still on the front page of Zero Hedge as we record this conversation, that China is injecting another $50 billion worth, $340 billion yuan, of liquidity into the Chinese markets. So they are desperately attempting to prop up the yuan right now. But devaluation is the order of the day, I think, and I think that's where it's heading. So. Of course, the knock-on effects of that we've already seen in the way that they have been unable to contain the falling stock market and the devaluation of the yuan is the sort of 1-2 punch of all of the disasters that we see spreading out through the Asian markets. And of course, we know that also affects U.S. markets at this point. So, again, I think it's not really – that isn't the underlying problem, but it is a symptom of the problem. The underlying problem, I think, is the slowdown in global trade. You can cover up any sort of ridiculous and untenable positions. As long as global trade is growing and everything's booming for the manufacturing sector, everything's fine and they can cover everything over. But they can't do that right now because global trade is contracting and the Chinese economy is contracting, or at least is not growing as quickly as it was before. So absolutely, I think this is the inflection point that a lot of people have been predicting for years now with regards to China. And a lot of people have been saying it's the emperor with no clothes. And everything that we've seen in the last 6 months, really, since the stock market started crashing, is showing more and more that that's the case.
Do you think China's going to get things under control in the near future, or how long is this problem going to persist?
I think it's the beach ball underwater effect. I think they can push down on various places using various mechanisms, but they can only do so for so long, and it only works for so long. And if you look at all sorts of different factors, like the offshore yuan, which, unlike the official PBOC yuan, is officially traded in a certain range that is fixed each day. The offshore yuan that you can buy in Hong Kong and other places is freely traded. And if you look at that, they keep trying to do these things, injecting liquidity and things, in order to keep the USD CNH value down, but it keeps spiking back up. So I think that, again, they keep trying to do things, and their interventions have less and less of an effect. And we've seen all of the other things they've been trying to do to prop up markets in various ways. The 7% circuit breaker that they tried very briefly and then repealed, that we talked about last week, and other things like that. A new story coming out about how China is going to start using public funds to cover venture capital losses. So, again, they've got a lot of tricks up their sleeve, but they are increasingly tricks that are having less and less effect on actually affecting the markets.
Well, the big problem the markets have is a loss of demand. People aren't buying stuff. What do you suppose the reason is for that? Is it simply, and there's not exactly a reason, it's a circular situation where the problem is caused by another problem, it's caused by another problem, it's caused by the first problem we were talking about in the first place. There's a circle here, but if you had this, what's causing the loss of demand? Are we fatigued by debt? That's the term I saw someone use, debt fatigue. We've just had enough of debt. I don't want to go in. I'm not going into, I don't care. That's a great deal on the car, but I'm not going into any more debt. Is that Is that part of the mindset that's afflicting the world? Go ahead.
I would phrase this as a debt hangover or a QE hangover, really, because it was Mike Maloney has been showing a chart which is quite revealing lately, where he charts the Wiltshire 5000, which is the market capitalized market cap weighted index of all of the stocks that are traded in the U.S. So a pretty good indication of general market activity in the U.S. And he's charting that against the Federal Reserve balance sheet. And there is no doubt there is a direct relation between the two. And I think we can understand how it's a causal relationship. The Fed QE injections of money into the reserves of these various banks is directly related to the markets and where they've been going over the last 7 or 8 years. Because again, I think it doesn't need a lot of elaboration that what we've seen in the markets over the last several years with those record levels is not a reflection of economic activity. So what we have seen is the QE-driven market bubble, and what we are seeing is that now that they're taking that back and trying to raise rates, we're seeing the unwinding of that. It's quite obvious. And that, obviously, the markets, again, don't indicate the economic activity, but they indicate the psychology of various players in the market, and including, I think this ultimately filters down to the Main Street level and what people are willing to buy in their own lives. So I think we've just seen a contraction of demand based on that, the sucking up of the liquidity.
I think from what I've observed over the last few months makes it increasingly clear that people aren't investing in the markets in the sense that you go in and you say, well, General Motors is a good stock. We've got good price-earning ratio and whatever and strong company. They're not doing that where they look at the market. They look at market fundamentals. They are investing based on what the Federal Reserve says is happening. Federal Reserve uses a word, right? And all of a sudden the market goes up, or they don't use the word and the market goes down. We're investing in Federal Reserve activity. As long as we think they're going to support the market, we'll invest. If they're not going to support the market, we bail out. It's not about fundamentals. We'll talk more about that in a moment when we return to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Adisk here with my guest, James Corbett, from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herb's emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
gentlemen. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James is located in Japan, and here's an article from the Phoenix Capital Research, and the headline is, "The Japanese Central Banker Just Leaked Something Incredible." They point out the European Central Bank and the U.S. Federal Reserve began implementing ZIRP, zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing, after 2008. But the Bank of Japan has been employing both ZIRP and quantitative easing since 2001 without any significant effect. They haven't been able to really stimulate their economy. Banker admitted this, just the head of the Bank of Japan, Haruhiko Kuroda, probably didn't get that. I may be close on that. I'm not sure if I pronounced it at all correctly, but the head of the Bank of Japan, he made a number of statements, and they, according to this article, one of the statements is an implicit admission that quantitative easing doesn't generate GDP growth. Anyone who studied quantitative easing knew this already, but it's an incredible admission from a central banker. These are the people responsible for instilling confidence in the system. This has just come out recently. It reminds me of Richard Fisher, who is the former president of the Dallas, or the Dallas Bar Association, the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. And he admitted recently the cause of the stock market decline shouldn't be blamed on China, but rather on the Federal Reserve. This is just a coincidence of two people that are in or close to the heads of central banks, and they're both saying blame the banking system, not China?
No, I think it's pretty much just an observation of reality that is difficult to deny at this point. And they're not the only ones. I have seen this formulation several times in the last few years from a lot of different people similarly placed within the banking system. And unfortunately, I don't have those references offhand, but I remember a particularly humorous one was from a former Federal Reserve governor. I can't remember which Federal Reserve Bank, but one of the Federal Reserve banks was saying that, was admitting that the Federal Reserve didn't understand really how QE fundamentally worked. They were just kind of, you know, going on a whim and a prayer. So these types of admissions have been made several times over the last years. And I think to some extent, I believe that some of these admissions are made to salt the record so that in retrospect, they'll be able to point to various admissions like these and go, look, see, we knew it. We were right. Even when they clearly pursued the wrong course of action for so long. I wouldn't say that the Japanese QE has been completely without effect, though. I think we certainly saw a run up in the Japanese stock market over the last couple of years, which is now unwinding as they begin to lose control of that. But we certainly did see that effect, and we did see the devaluation of the yen. The JPY-USD did change over the last couple of years to weaken the yen. But again, it's the balloon, balloon underwater. They just can't keep it underwater for very long.
Well, it's the same thing with China. They're trying to use quantitative easing, which really hasn't been, it's had some positive effect. It has perhaps prevented nations and or the global economy from just utter collapse. Could have happened after 2008, 2007, 2008. Could have gone completely south. They stopped it from going completely south, but they pretty much stopped it just at the border. We almost went to Mexico. We didn't quite go into Mexico, but we almost went that far. What do you make of China trying to use quantitative easing to solve its problems? They have to know it didn't work for Japan to a significant degree. It didn't work for the United States to a significant degree. Is there really any hope that this is going to work for China?
Well, I guess we have to be careful because quantitative easing does have a technical definition, which is not does not really describe most of the interventions that the Chinese government or the People's Bank of China have been making. Specifically, quantitative easing is buying certain assets like treasuries or mortgage-backed securities or that type of thing, direct buying of that by the central bank in an attempt to load liquidity into the reserves of these banks. That is not the way China has been doing it. So it's been termed China's QE or Chinese style QE, or it's been analogized, but I don't think that's an accurate analogy when you get down to the technical level. So what they're doing is not exactly what the Federal Reserve has been doing, but certainly they have just been throwing, they're increasingly just throwing money at the markets and hoping, you know, that will make a difference. And I think we are seeing that's not having the effect. So I think they're going down a similar path, but not really the same path. They're just taking a different route to get there.
I wrote an article just lately of something that I believe is probably correct. Well, we can talk about that later. Here's another one. Here's an article from Newsroom. It says, sheer panic. The headline, sheer panic. Bank runs have begun in Italy. This is about a week old, 6 days old. Milan, a run has begun on Italian banks with the depositors taking out money in a panic, fearing they will lose everything if they leave their money deposited. Is this more exaggeration? Is there really a potential panic taking place in Italy, or is this confined to one or two banks and not really a trend, just a couple of bumps in the road?
That's a very good question. I'm going to have to admit I didn't see the stories of that particular incident, so I can't really comment on it specifically, but it certainly does seem to be a reflection of the fact that the Eurozone banking crises are certainly not under control, and the contagion, as it were, is still spreading around in the system and could, who knows where it could strike next? One of the so-called pigs countries like Italy, or could it spread to the rest of the system? I mean, I think this is still very much an open question, one that has been perhaps conveniently swept under the rug by other events taking place in Europe right now that grab the headlines, but the banking crises there are still certainly not under control. So to hear that there was a banking run last week in Italy does not surprise me, unfortunately, and I think it's, again, just reflective of the fact that the situation is still very much up in the air in the Eurozone generally.
George Soros has made a comment that he thinks that Europe is in danger of some sort of collapse. Is that a reasonable, there again, is that an exaggeration?
Well, no. I mean, again, it really depends on a number of factors. But one of them that I think we should at least be taking into account here is the possibility of Brexit, as they're now calling it, that the UK is actually going to have a referendum, supposedly. I think by the end, before the end of 2017, they're going to have a referendum on exiting the Euro, the European Union, which is not the Eurozone, but will obviously have a fundamental effect on the European Union project in general, if it does take place, and will undoubtedly affect the Eurozone as an economic entity as well, even though Britain, of course, is not a member of the Eurozone. But, I mean, those types of considerations, including the ongoing crisis in Greece, it's not that that crisis has been fully resolved. It's just that it's not making daily headlines anymore. But certainly things like that can, again, flare up, or you can have Italian bank runs or other things that start to spread panic. So the idea that the Eurozone is out of danger is, I mean, I think you'd have to be naive to believe that. It's just a question of, you know, I think fundamentally, again, the question for me is, which way will the Eurozone fail? Will they fail forward in a way that's convenient for the central bankers to step in and say, hey, you know, this just proves we need even more control?
An article here from Zero Hedge that was published yesterday, and the headline was Something Snapped at the Comics. And it says, in part, it says, yesterday, when the latest update from the COMEX vault came in, we learned that a whopping 201,000 ounces of registered gold had been dewarranted at the owner's request and shifted to the eligible category, reducing the total amount of COMEX registered gold by 73%, from 275,000 to just 74,000 overnight. I know what they're talking about is how much gold can be delivered. And as you go on, they say this means the ratio of physical to paper gold dilution right now is in the neighborhood of 542 ounces of paper claims against every ounce of physical gold. Does this imply that the real cost, that a legitimate price, if there's 500 ounces of paper gold claims on each 1 ounce
of physical gold. Does this suggest the price of physical gold should be 500 times the current price?
I know that sounds irrational.
They had $50,000 an ounce.
Yeah, $50,000 gold. Well, I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because we can imagine a market in which there is room for some paper transactions as well. But clearly 500 plus ounces to one is ridiculous. And the idea that this is fundamentally a sustainable move in the market is, again, ridiculous. So various people have estimated this in various ways over the years. And I believe I have seen the $50,000 an ounce number floated as the realistic sum.
Yeah, but I've seen people talk about it.
But I'm not sure if we'll ever get there. But the idea that this is, I mean, that the current prices are maintainable is, again, I mean, it's only a reflection of people's faith in the fiat system and the monies that they're getting from their central banks. So in times of crisis, I mean, exactly as we're talking about with Brazil or whatever, and people holding U.S. physical U.S. dollars, again, holding precious metals can be the exact same type of hedge that people use, except in this case, it's a universally recognized hedge that's been operating for thousands of years. So again, all this type of story really says to me, and I don't know about you, but I've seen this type of story several times over the last several years that I've been following this. All it says is, don't buy paper gold at this point. I mean, if you don't have it in your hand, assuming you're buying it as a hedge, if you're just buying it as an investment, you want to turn it around and, you know, come in and out of the market, then sure, whatever, play the paper and, you know, suffer the consequences if they come. But if you are buying precious metals as a hedge against possible currency collapse or calamity or global currency reset or anything of that sort, then buy physical metal that you can physically hold in your hand, or else you don't really have it.
I agree. We've got probably 2 minutes left. We've got an article here from Ms. Shedlock. It says, Fourth Industrial Revolution, robots, artificial intelligence will destroy 5.1 million jobs by 2020. He's quoting from a study, The Future of Jobs, by the World Economic Forum at Davos. Claims that a Fourth Industrial Revolution is coming. That Japan may be something like the canary in the coal mine. I'm going to guess that Japan has far more robots on a per capita basis than most other nations. Is that causing distress, or is it am I right, first off? And if so, is it causing distress in the Japanese economy, or are people just adjusting? No big thing.
I can't speak to the industrial uses of robotics in manufacturing or anything of that sort compared to other countries. I don't have the figures on that, but I can say, at least for the general cultural conditioning to robots, even on the personal level, I would say Japan is much more advanced, in that there are they've even recently released, you know, kind of personal robots that are supposed to be more and more a part of daily life here. And I've seen them in certain stores where it's just a novelty item at this point. But basically, uh-huh, you come in and you can hold a little conversation with this robotic friend. So the public is definitely being indoctrinated into accepting it at this point, and it's becoming more sort of natural seeming to people who are steeped in this. But again, how that translates in the business world compared to other countries, I'm not sure of. But it is a trend that I don't see derailing anytime in the near future. I think the only question is whether these robot workers will be paid with digital virtual currency.
Maybe Bitcoin. We could give them Bitcoin, perhaps. Want to thank you for being on the program. As always, James, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Hope to talk to you again next week. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, all the audience, and Frank the producer. Good night, folks.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.